Okay, so I'll just put up, I think, what I think was the last slide that I was showing last time, and I'll summarize a little bit what happened in the previous lecture. So I was explaining the background of the work that Alain and I did, which is the Cohn-Kreimer theory of perturbative renormalization. And to summarize very quickly what the main point is that when you use the Bogolyubov, Parashuk, Hebb-Zimmermann formalism for renormalization in perturbative quantum field theory, this has a very nice geometric interpretation, and the formula of BPHZ are on the nose a recursive inductive formula for the Birkhoff factorization of loops in a certain pro-unipotent Lie group, complex Lie group, which is the complex points of an affine group scheme, which is dual to a certain commutative off algebra. And the commutative off algebra depends on the physical theory, is the one that sort of encodes the information about the physical theory, and it's the off algebra of Feynman graphs, which I described last time. So this is somehow, in a nutshell, what happens in this reinterpretation of BPHZ. Now, what I did not discuss last time.
Phi is the, those are the series of divergent integrals?
Right, so phi, you.
Phi is an off algebra or is U?
Phi is an element in G of K, where K is your field of Lorentz series, either formal or convergent Lorentz series. Okay. And so it means that this phi is a homomorphism from the Hopf algebra to Lorentz series. So it takes a generator. That's right. So you take a generator of the Hopf algebra, which is a Feynman graph, and it spits out for you a Lorentz series, which is what you obtain by doing dim reg. And that. So
that's
the phi. Right. Yeah, starting from this fact that when you do dimensional regularization, you get things which have an analytic continuation to and have a Lorentz series expansion at z equals zero. And then minimal subtraction by removing the polar part of the Lorentz series. But you have to do that according to this BPHZ scheme where you account for the nested subdivergences and so on with this formula. So, and this is kind of summarized in this form where this phi picks the unrenormalized values, so the Lorentz series associated to the unrenormalized values, and the phi minus is the part that gives you the counter terms. I mean, when you apply it to a generator of the Hopf algebra, it gives you the corresponding counter terms. And the phi plus, which is the part of the Birkhoff factorization which is regular at zero, is the one that gives you the renormalized value, which is the evaluation at zero of that term.
What was the formula relating phi, phi minus, and phi plus? That's sort of the essence,
right? Right. So, I mean, this... Okay, right. The... I don't have the slide here, but I mean the point was that this is just a translation of, you have a loop. Well, in fact, I'm going to explain in a moment, everything depends on a mass scale, but let's forget this for a moment. You have a loop, and the Birkhoff factorization means that you can factor it as a product of two things, one of which is holomorphic away from zero, and the other one is regular at zero. And the phi, okay, you think of this, so gamma is now an infinitesimal loop, from an infinitesimal puncture disk around zero to the complex points of this affine group scheme. But you encode that. Right, and G is this, G is the G of your chosen physical theory. And phi, you encode this data equivalently by an element in the homomorphisms of algebras from H to K, where K is your field of, say, convergent Lorentz series. Okay, so the phi, that's right. So when you translate, you have a corresponding phi minus, that corresponds to this gamma minus piece, and a phi plus that corresponds to this gamma plus piece. And this formula just becomes the fact that phi is this phi minus, well, taking the inverse means composing with the antipode in the Hopf algebra, and then the product is the one that's dual to the coproduct of the Hopf algebra, and here we will have the phi plus. So that formula shows inductively that for a group like this group of diffeographism, which is the affine group scheme of a graded connected Hopf algebra, like that, you always can factor a loop and a loop in here. You can always factor it like this, and this gives you inductively how you factor it.
Is there some intuition that you can have non-trivial bundles for GLM over
right.
the sphere?
Right.
But is there some intuition that this diffeographism group is sort of upper triangular?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's sort of, I mean, it sort of reflects the fact, the structure of the Hopf algebra, right? This fact that it's graded connected, so, no, you have...
Oh, I see, with this grading, with just positive.
Right, yeah.
That algebraic property corresponds to...
Corresponds to the fact that you have, like, upper triangular matrices and the projective limit of upper triangular matrices. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, one point... So I stopped here last time, but what I didn't say is the fact that, in fact, in everything here, you have a dependence on an extra parameter, which is a mass scale. And this comes from the fact that, at the beginning when I wrote the unrenormalized values as integral in dimension d minus z, so you have it's a Lorentz series in z, but in fact it depends also on some parameter mu, because you sort of want this to be the integral of dk1 to d minus z, and okay, as many variables, internal variables as the loop number, but then you will have a sort of mass, something, or mass or energy scale to the mu L, where L is the loop number. And then you have this integrand, which is given by the Feynman rules. Yeah, Z, of course. Sorry. Pn, right. So you have this extra parameter to take into account. And so this Birkhoff factorization also depends on this parameter. So now one can see exactly how it depends on this parameter. This is also part of the Cohn-Kreimer story. So what they show is that the loops which come from this data of renormalization depend on this parameter with these two properties. So, okay, the first one is kind of obvious by this fact. It just reflects the fact that it scales according to the loop number. So you have a one parameter family of automorphisms of the Hopf algebra and induced automorphism of the corresponding affine group scheme, which are generated by the operator that gives the grading of the Hopf algebra. And so this y is the one that on the pieces of degree n multiplies by n. And the dependence on this mu parameter for the full loop before you factorize it is like this. If you scale this parameter, it corresponds to acting by this family of automorphism. Just says that it scales like the loop number. That's the same thing that I wrote there. And there is another condition which will turn out to be quite important in the following, is that when you factorize it with the Birkhoff factorization, the part that gives you the counter terms actually does not depend on this mass scale. Whereas, okay, the part which gives you the finite values, of course, does depend on that, and you get the action of the renormalization group by scaling this parameter. So, in fact, the renormalization group appears in this theory as a one-parameter subgroup of the group G of diffeographisms. So, I mean, it's lifted at the level of the group of diffeographisms. And it comes from looking at the scaling, if you want, of the remaining piece of the plus part. And it will give the usual action of the renormalization group on the finite values. So, in particular...
Because it moves to the Z, multiplies the Laurent series in Z, if I then expand the disease powers of Z, it seems like I would get polar terms that depend on log mu.
But you will have a log mu.
So I don't quite understand this point star here, blue log.
This part.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, this actually, you know, if you want, it's sort of lifted right out of Colling's book. The counter terms don't depend on this mass scale.
Dimensional.
But you understand my question? I'm saying if I take mu to the z and I multiply that by a Laurent series,
right?
And I'm trying to interpret the result. But
right. No, I mean, in a moment, I will write. In a moment, I will write very explicitly what happens. I mean, I will write much more explicitly all the terms that appear here, and then you will see. But I mean, I will give very explicit formulas in a moment, so maybe that will help. I mean, if that doesn't clarify the point, we'll get to it again. But I mean, I think everything will become a lot more explicit in a moment, so that will probably help to clarify this point. So the beta function here appears, which is the infinitesimal generator of the renormalization group, here appears as an element in the Lie algebra of this group of diffeographisms. And it has a description of this form. You can take the residue of gamma at zero, and beta is given by y, this grading y times the residue. And one can show that this gives, in fact, the infinitesimal generator of f. Okay, so just a... summarize the end of the Kronkheimer story. We have that VPHZ is an instance of this general formalism of Birkhoff factorization, which, you know, gives a multiplicative splitting of something in a finite part and in a divergent part. And what comes out in the end is that the data of perturbative renormalization, so the unrenormalized values, the counter terms, and the renormalized value, can be packaged together as a particular class of loops with values in this pro-unipotent Lie group. And these are those loops which satisfy these two properties on the dependence on this extra parameter. And, okay, from that one gets the divergences and the renormalized values. So, of course, given this now as the sort of end point of the Kronkheimer story, one would like to get a better description or a better understanding of this class of loops, of what these two properties mean, and how one can sort of classify this data and understand, especially the gamma minus part, will tell you something about the structure of divergences. And, you know, if you can get a good understanding of this class of loops, then you can, you know, try to understand more about the general structure of divergences across different possible theories and so on. So now the purpose of the rest of the talk, now we start to talking about the joint work with Alain, and we'll try to get, you know, better hold of this set of data. It's okay, so here there won't be any problem because it's a scale. Yeah, that's right. That did. Yeah.
It's just some set of loops.
That's right. It's a certain class of loops. That's okay. In the end, no, I will give a better description of that, not in terms of a class of loop, but in terms of some class of differential systems, and then it will be.
Factor mu to the ZL, it won't intervene in the quadratic first order. Now, the reason why you don't have a dependence in mu is the same as why you don't have terms in log of a momentum. It's exactly the same. Counter terms. It's because the formula for counter terms is quite complicated.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'll put out the explicit formula. Okay, so now, I mean, to get to this, I mean, as I said, I sort of mumbled something about the fact that I want to use a description in terms of a class of differential systems to reformulate this data. And the way I want to do that is through, you know, we did it through a certain, you know, general technique in mathematics, which is the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence, so I will say a few things in general about what the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence is and what type of, you know, techniques are involved. But, you know, in a few words, it's a correspondence where on the one hand you have a certain class of analytic data. Typically they are certain classes of differential systems or certain classes of connections up to some equivalence relation, or classes of differential equations up to some equivalence relation. And you want to classify them in terms of some representation theoretic data. Okay, the typical example one has in mind is you have a holomorphic differential equation with singularities on the Riemann sphere. You want to say that the equation is uniquely determined by the monodromy representation of the solution. So this is the sort of prototype model of the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence. Of course, this is sort of historically the origin of it, but then it generalized in a very wide form. So I will give a little bit of general nonsense to say what type of things are involved. So there is we have in mind the idea that we want in the end to produce a classification of something in terms of representations of some representation theoretic data. So you have some data you want to classify, and you want to identify them with representations of a group. And that will be your classification in terms of, so you want to produce a group out of a set of data. So there is a formalism called the Tanakian formalism in mathematics, which does exactly that. You have a set of data organized with enough rigid properties, and that automatically produces for you a group and identifies this data with the category of finite dimensional linear representations of that group. So, okay, the general framework is in this sort of general categorical nonsense. So you organize your data in a category, but this category has to be rigid enough. So first of all, it has to allow you to use the tools of homological algebra. So that's what is called an abelian category. I mean, an abelian category is a category where homological algebra applies. And this means, basically, that the homomorphism between different objects have to be abelian groups, that they have to be products and coproducts, and that they have to be kernels and co-kernels. If you have that, basically everything that you can do in homological algebra, you can apply to this category. And the basic you know, example is modules over some ring. So this is not enough rigid structure. It's something that you definitely want to have. You want to have something more. You want with the homomorphism not to just to be abelian group, but to be vector spaces. And you want to have some tensor product available in your category. Okay, and you have to have the associativity and commutativity property up to natural isomorphism and so on. And so you have to have a tensor product. So like vector spaces, for example. And you want to have a duality, like, you know, the dual space. And this duality have to have some, you know, natural properties. You know, want to have some evaluation from an object tensor its dual to a unit, and a corresponding morphism the other way from one to an object tensor its dual. And in fact, in particular, this defines for you a good notion of dimension in a category like that, because you have a good definition of trace of the identity morphism on an object, which is composition of these two things, this delta and epsilon, well, with the thing that switches the two factors in between. Okay, a little bit of extra structure. On top of having a category which is a rigid tensor category, which I just explained, so it's a bit more than being able to use homological algebra. It has also this tensor structure and has this duality structure. You also want to have a functor from your category to vector spaces. And you want to, so you want to be able to map your data to vector spaces in a way which is faithful, so I mean you don't lose homomorphisms by doing that. Well, compatible with the fact that the things are linear vector spaces, so it has to have be a linear map. Exact, so you don't want to, you want to preserve the fact that you do the operation of homological algebra and they are mapped sort of faithfully on the other side to vector spaces. And that is compatible with all the structure you have, with tensor products and units and so on. So when you have something like that, you say that this is a fiber functor, so an exact faithful tensor functor from your category to vector spaces over some field which in general may be an extension of the one over which you're working. So a category is called Tanakian if it has a fiber functor like this. It's called neutral Tanakian if, in fact, you don't have to pass to an extension of the field over which you take vector spaces. You can just map it to vector spaces over the same field over which you're working. So here's the, after doing all this general nonsense, the reward you get is this fact, this result, which was due to Grothendieck, I mean, Rivano, Deligne, and so on, these various versions. But basically, that if your data organized in this form, so as a neutral Tanakian category, this is equivalent to the category of finite dimensional linear representation of a certain group, or in fact, of a certain affine group scheme. And this group is just the automorphisms of this fiber functor. So the invertible natural transformation of the fiber functor to itself, compatible with the tensor or product, compatible with all the structure. And this is like a Galois group for this category. So this is a way to sort of produce for you a group of symmetries. So, well, for example, if
so I guess you're giving us all the examples.
Well, for example,
I was going to ask you what's an example.
Right. Well, the Galois group is an example. So, if you take a I don't know Q for example, and take the absolute Galois group of Q bar over Q, so there is a category which is the category of Artin motives over Q, which is a Tanakian category. I mean, it's a category which, well, when you start with something very simple, zero dimensional algebraic varieties over Q. Okay. So just simplest possible thing, zero dimensional algebraic varieties. And okay, the trouble in general, this is the idea of motives. The trouble in general is algebraic varieties are not an abelian category. You cannot do kernels and co-kernels. You have morphism of algebraic varieties, but they don't have, you cannot use directly homological algebra. But you can embed, if you change what, I mean, if you allow for something slightly more general than morphisms given by maps, but you allow for morphism given by correspondences, so by algebraic cycles in the product of two varieties, then you can construct a category in which the category of algebraic varieties sits, but which now is an abelian category. Okay, choosing suitably some equivalence relation on the cycle. I will say a little more later, but the idea of motives is you embed algebraic varieties into something which is an abelian category, where you can use all the tools of homological algebra and so on.
Can you give it more elementary?
Yes, now I'm going to come to the examples which... Right, I have an example which is right here in the next slide. So this is an example. Take the representation of Z.
Okay.
That's as simple as that. Okay. Finite dimensional linear representations of Z. Okay, this is a category which it has all the right properties already. You can check that the category of representations of a group have all the properties that I listed. And the fiber functor is just the one that forgets the structure, so it just maps a representation to the underlying vector space. So no problem with that. So this is, by the previous result, the representations of a certain affine group scheme. This affine group scheme is something a bit more complicated than Z itself. It is what is called the algebraic hull of Z. And it is the affine group scheme dual to a certain commutative off algebra, which is polynomials in two types of generators. So just you have one variable T and you have this EQ for Q in C mod Z with a certain relations. You know, these sort of behave like exponentials, and these have the co-product, which is group-like. And then here you have T, which is a primitive element.
So T was in Z?
That's right. So basically, this corresponds to the fact that you have a Jordan form for matrices, said in a sort of fancier way. That's right. So actually, okay, this example now looks a bit perfect, but I will get back to it with a different interpretation a little bit later. So now let me give a useful class of cases where this Tanakian formalism has been used and applied. And that is differential Galois theory. So where the category of the data you're trying to organize is some category of differential equations, is some or connections or no, linear systems. So in this case, say you're working over a differential field, so typically it could be, I don't know, say convergent Lorentz series or formal Lorentz series. And well, you can assume that the kernel of the differential is C. So just usually, if the kernel of the differential is an algebraically closed field, things work better. So let's make that assumption. So you look at the category of differential modules.
So delta is just
right, in this case. So in general, no, you could have a differential field is just, you have a differentiation, so you have something which, is additive on addition, it has the Leibniz rule on multiplication. So in this case, it would be a speed d by dz. And if you take you can take differential modules over K, so it means that you have pairs of a vector space and a connection, and the homomorphisms are just linear maps that intertwine the connection. And okay, it is a rigid tensor category because you can have an induced connection on the tensor product, and you have an induced connection on the dual space, so everything.
Is it similar but slightly different from modules over algebra and differential algebra?
Yeah, you can, sure, I mean, if you, you can make a version where you start with an algebra differential operators and you look at modules over that. I mean, the point is I'm just interested in a very particular case, which is the local case. So I will always be working only on in a neighborhood of zero, of a single with just one singular point at zero, and in an infinitesimal neighborhood of zero. So I take Lorentz series and so on. Actually, what you're doing works more generally. Like if you have a variety, you can take an algebra of differential operators, then you allow for more general types of singularities and so on. So here I'm really just looking at the local Riemann-Hilbert correspondence where you only have one singularity. So in this case, the fiber functor is just the one that sends a differential equation to the set of solutions, to the vector space of solutions. And okay, one can show that this has all the properties that I listed, so it's rigid enough that it can be identified with the representations of a certain affine group scheme. So this is its general theory. I give you in part to Ramis and to other people as well. So this group has an interesting structure. It has a part which is again this algebraic hull of Z that I mentioned before, and is the part that corresponds to the monodromy around this singular point. I mean, the Z will be the generator of the pi 1 of the punctured disk. But it has more than just the monodromy around the singular point. It has this sort of exponential torus, which corresponds to the fact that you can have solutions which are sort of exponentially flat at the zero. And okay, for if you're working right, some things like that, yeah, they go like exponential. Right. Yeah. So that accounts for those type. In fact, these generators of this exponential torus are sort of things which, in sectors around a singular point, they look like e to the minus with some constants. And okay, if you are in the okay, these are formal solutions. So I mean, when you work with here, you work with formal Lorentz series. So you only look in a formal solution. Now, if you want to look at actual solutions, so you look at convergent Lorentz series, then this group becomes more complicated because you take formal solutions, which are just asymptotic solutions, you try to resum, so typically they are divergent series, but you have this resummation method like Borel resummation or multi-resummation. You try to sum them to get some actual solutions. But typically you can only do that in sectors, and when you go to another sector, you have a transition function between the two. And this adds some extra generators to this differential Galois group, which are correspond to this Stokes phenomenon, I mean, which are exactly these transition functions between two adjacent sectors when you try to resum divergent series. So in this, typically in this non-formal case, this differential Galois group is more complicated. But okay, this is for the whole class of solutions. I mean, for the whole class of differential equations over this field with all possible types of singularities at zero. But then you can restrict to certain subclasses. Right?
So let me see. Does this question make sense? If I take the Bessel equation and look at Z equals infinity, do I associate the transition function with that?
It corresponds to one particular representation of this group.
Oh, I see. That's one representation.
That's right. I mean, every is a representation of, or at least its equivalence class in the is a corresponds to a representation. I mean, if you want, okay, let me do it like this. So take one particular equation like you have in mind. So take one particular equation with singularities at z equals zero. It doesn't matter for the moment. So then you look at the subcategory of this category of differential module, which is spanned by that single object. This gives you, you can take the smallest subcategory with all the structure, which is spanned by this single object. This will have a corresponding group, and in particular, there will be a map from this general one to this particular one, and this particular one is the differential Galois group of that equation. So if you take the...
So what would be the Galois group?
Okay, so typically when you actually want to compute...
Irregular, but
no, I think typically when you want to compute the... Yeah, no, so what you do typically when you want to compute the differential Galois group of an equation is, I mean, there's a slightly different way to get at it than this one. So what you do is you construct this Picard-Vaisseau extension. So, I mean, typically what happens is that your differential equation does not necessarily have all... I mean, if it's an order n equation, it will have n independent solutions, but not all of them will be in the field K in which the equation is defined. You will have to go to some extension in which you have n solutions. And then you will take the Galois group as the differential fields of that extension over the field, and that will be the differential Galois group of the equation. But the point here is that you get it also this way, with a map from this. So it's always some if you want, well, some map or some quotient or something of this general one. So it always has somehow this form, but adapted to the particular equation you're looking at. Another example is if you pick those equations which are regular singular. So now you don't allow any arbitrary type of singularity at zero, you only allow the regular singular ones. And so then it means that, okay, this A has to be up to conjugation, up to gauge transformation, it has to be of this form where B is regular. And okay, this will form a subcategory of that. And now, okay, the Galois group for this subcategory is exactly this this algebraic Hall of Z, because those are determined by the monodromy representation. So you, there, everything you need is that. You don't have any extra part of this Galois group. Okay. So this is, I hope, some sort of convincing picture of this Tanakian formalism and Galois groups and so on.
Can you explain that more in more detail? So if the usual Galois group is analogous by 1, then the differential Galois group is by 1 of what?
Well, I mean, it is the Galois group of, for a given equation, you should think of it as being the Galois group of the minimal extension in which you have all the solutions that you expect to have over the field of which you're working, right? So it is...
But can I think of
a
fundamental group of something?
It's more like a complete monomial. What you have is the usual monomial suffices for regular singularity. But for irregular singularities, you have to add additional monomial.
Right, so...
In the Stokes matrix?
For instance,
right. So, I mean, in fact, if you want, this thing is also called this wild fundamental group of the punctured disk. So the Z, the monodromy part, would be the usual fundamental group. But this, okay, has additional stuff on top of the usual fundamental group. So, yeah. It's, okay, so... What I want to aim at is the fact that there is a similar form of the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence associated to the data of perturbative renormalization. So it will not be directly following from this case that I mentioned now, because this is different in a few crucial points. So first of all, it will not just be over the punctured disk. There will be an extra dimension, because there is this dependence on the mu parameter that I mentioned. So you will have the z will be just the usual z of the imreg, but there will be also this extra mu dependence. So it will be a Riemann-Hilbert correspondence now not on the one-dimensional case, but on a two-dimensional complex manifold. And also, okay, the equivalence relation, I mean, unlike, for example, what I put here for the regular singular case, in the regular singular case, you know, you say that something is regular singular if up to an equivalence given by an invertible matrix with any coefficients in this Hahn-series, it is of this form. So this is kind of the natural equivalence relation in this setting. Here, the natural equivalence relation will be by gauge transformation, but by elements which are regular at zero. And the reason will be that this equivalence relation, as I will show in a moment, will correspond to picking loops that have the same negative part of the Birkhoff factorization. So we're sort of, you know, focusing on understanding the structure of the divergences. So we want to identify things which have the same.
But you're still looking at differential equations.
Yeah, I'll say where the differential. Yeah, but I'll still be looking at differential equations. That's right. I will say, I mean, I will rephrase those data in a way that they will become differential equations. The beta function will play, I mean, so the step will be, I will write that in terms of some iterated integrals involving the beta function, and then those will be naturally solutions of certain class of differential equations. So I will get at the differential equations that way. And also, so, okay, the type of connections that I will get that way are things which have singularities with all kinds of behavior. So you allow for arbitrary degree of irregularity in the connection. So they will not be regular singular in general. And the Galois group, in fact, will not depend on this difference between working with the formal Lorentz series or with the convergent Lorentz series. It's just a class for which no Stokes phenomena appear. So in that sense, it's simple. Okay, so this is a little preview of where I want to get. Okay, so let's get back to our data. We have these loops. Satisfied is in these two properties, and we want to focus on the structure of the divergences for this data. Okay. So a first step, which is already in the work of Kahn Kreimer, is you take the, you write the negative piece in this form, in the form of a series, where these are elements in the Hopf algebra. And one shows that, well, actually in the dual of algebra, okay? And one shows that they satisfy this recursive relation where y is the grading operator and beta is the beta function, the generator of the renormalization group. Okay, once you have it in this form, you can see that, in fact, you can give a closed form expression for this gamma minus as a function of beta only in the form of an iterated integral. And let me just show you. So, okay, let me just, yeah, show the formula first, and then I'll say, yeah. Okay, let me just first say what the iterated integral, the type of form I want to get for it. So, I want to write it. I will write it using this expression I just showed in a form of a iterated integral, by which I mean something of this form. So, if you have a g-valued smooth function, the time-ordered exponential or Chen iterated integral or Araki expansional, it has various names in the literature, is just this sum, this infinite sum, where you integrate over the ordered times. And the product here is the product of these viewed as elements in they are elements in the Lie algebra, but you can view them as elements in the dual of algebra. So you take the product there. So in particular, if you pair them with an element in the Hopf algebra, this boils down to a finite sum. This is actually why you don't have to worry about these problems of working in the formal setting or in the non-formal setting, because it actually, once you pair it with a fixed element in the Hopf algebra, it will boil down to a finite sum. Yeah, because suppose that it sits in some, H is a direct sum of graded pieces, Hn. So, if you take an element which is in some Hn, only a finite number of this will evaluate non-trivially on it. Yes. So you can pair it with an element in the Hopf algebra. But this is also That's right.
So there are degree at least one. So the product of n of them has degree at least n. You cannot pair with something of I say.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the point is, when you have an expression like this, it is naturally the solution of a differential equation. Okay, so this will be the point of passing from data. Once you can write your data in this form, you can think of them as an associated differential equation, which will be this one. Okay. So, for the gamma minus, which you have, in fact, by the formula I showed before, is that you can write the gamma minus as an iterated integral in this form, where here everything depends only on the beta function. This is a reformulation of something which is known as the Toft relations in the physical literature, namely that the counter terms can be expressed as a function of the beta function. And this is explicit way of writing the counter terms in terms. Well, apparently it's an unpublished result, but.
You should help us with the references on that, because.
Yeah, we.
Well, that formula for.
Okay, so you should give us a precise reference.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. Anyway, okay, it is a way of expressing the count of terms as a function of the beta function. And okay, it comes from the formula I said before, just by writing explicitly these terms as iterated integrals in beta, using this recursive formula for the end. So this means if you have a loop, so the first step in understanding this class of loops is that if you have a loop in this class, so it means it has these two properties on the dependence of beta, right, then you can always write it in this form, where you have something which is a exponential, I mean an iterated integral of the form I wrote before. Now, okay, here the mu dependence appears, and you have a term which is just something regular at zero. Okay, so this will be, in the end, this will be thrown into the equivalence relation on the connections. So the things that are regular at zero, you don't worry about, because we're sort of concentrating on understanding the divergent part. Okay. So in particular, this means that up to something which is regular at zero, everything is described in terms of an element in the Lie algebra, which is the one that corresponds to the beta function.
Yeah, it sort of sits above the usual beta function, but.
Beta. I don't know of any other, no.
How did you write it, David? How did you write it in your
paper? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, from this expression you read off the Birkhoff factorization explicitly. Now you just take the part which is convergent at zero, and you take the part which is normalized by being one at infinity. That factorization is unique, and so this gives you back exactly that thing. And the plus part has a part here which now is regular at zero, and it has the mu dependence explicitly.
But you recognize a statement that the beta function determines the
Okay, so now let's pass to we want to pass to the corresponding class of differential equations from these data. Okay, now we have written them more explicitly in this form, in the form of iterated integrals, so we can try to look at the corresponding differential equations. Okay, so take any flat connection with values in the Lie algebra of G, and then if you write the corresponding iterated integral of this connection, it depends only on the homotopy class of the path, since the connection is flat. And if you take any differential field and you look at the group G of K, you can write this type of differential equation in G of K with D. So, you have everywhere a G which is fixed, which is your group of diffeographisms. It's always there around, right? So I say, I want to say that given a connection, I can write this type of equation as an equation in the Lie algebra of this G of K, where K is whatever will be convergent Lorentz series or formal Lorentz series would be. And you have always this log derivative, because you have a differential field, so you can always say in the group you can always write these log derivatives values in the Lie algebra. And okay, the condition, the necessary condition for the existence of solutions of this differential equation is the vanishing of the monodromy representation. Okay, the monodromy representation has to be a little careful in defining it, because the group is a projective limit of finite dimensional complex Lie group, and you can define it at each level, because if you want at each level, you're working with a disk of some positive radius, a puncture disk of some positive radius. In the limit, you're really working with an infinitesimal disk, so you don't have a choice of a base point for the pi 1. But the condition of the monodromy being trivial is well defined in the limit. So that's all you need for ensuring the existence of solutions. And, okay, on these differential equations, on these connections, there is a natural equivalence relation, which is the one of gauge transformation by an element now in G of O, meaning those that give you a Lorentz series which is convergent at zero. The reason for choosing that is that, okay, this equivalence relation is in fact the same as requiring that two equations of this sort have solutions that have the same negative part of the Birkhoff factorization. So we're really concentrating on understanding the negative part of the Birkhoff factorization. We want to identify, basically we want to throw away this part that was coming from this piece that is regular at zero in the previous description of the loop, and only concentrate on the divergences.
So I think of two different differential equations coming from two different theories.
Well, okay.
Somehow have the same divergence.
So at the moment the group of diffeographisms is fixed.
Oh, I see. So the theory but you, is fixed for the
right. So but you still have, even for the same possible different choices of the loop. Because you.
Right.
So for the moment, it's still the theory is fixed. The point is that at some point we do this so that at some point we can compare different theories within the same framework. So once we build up the class of differential equations. Right.
The d by dt of gamma minus zero and so on. But I see. But
right.
So I guess I'm losing the general philosophy. So I mean, theory gives you a loop gamma mu of z. Now
okay.
A theory gives you
two things. It gives you the group of diffeographisms, and it gives you a loop. But in fact, it gives you a family of loops, for example, because you have this mu dependence. Or
okay, I could have said that.
And okay, you could have no other
double loop or something like gamma.
You could have other symmetries that.
Then you characterize it, and you're going through all this to try and characterize the set of loops which satisfy some axioms.
Right. And in particular, in the end, one point is that I would like to get to a point where you can compare different theories in one same framework. So where I will have, I will be able to drop the group G, or at least put all for different groups of diffeographisms for different theories, compare all of this data within one same larger category. Okay. So to give the right class of connections, there's one thing that so far I didn't put in, which is this mu dependence. Exactly, I mean this parameter. So the type of connection, as I said before, you will have an extra dimension. So you don't just work over the disk or the punctured disk, but you have some vibration over it where with C star as the fiber, which means that, okay, you have variable Z coming from dim reg, and you also have sort of a choice of normalization of your integral in dimension D minus Z. And that, you know, allows for this, you know, scaling of the mu parameter, for example. And so you work with connections over, not over delta times G, but over this B, which has this other dimension, and it times G. And now, okay, I want to describe these two properties here of the loop in terms of the connections, in terms of a class of connections over this space. Okay. So these connections, okay, they're going to be flat connection here, and we call them equisingular. They have two properties. One corresponds to the scaling property, and it's just that the connection is invariant under the action of the multiplicative group, which acts, of course, on the, well, on the base by, and on the, I mean, on the other, I mean, on the G by the grading of the Hopf algebra. Okay. And the other condition, which corresponds to this condition here, now is very geometrically formulated. Namely, if you take two sections, you can choose a trivialization of this vibration by choosing a global section of delta B. If you choose two different sections, you can restrict the connection to these two sections and look at the behavior at the origin. It will have the singularity of the origin. So you want them to have the same type of singularity at the origin, regardless of along which section you approach the singular fiber. So you say this, you know, your phrase is saying that if you take the pullback along two different sections which have the same value at zero, then the two connections you get are equivalent in the sense I said before, so in the sense that they are equivalent through a regular element, gauge conjugation by a regular element. So the type of singularity that you get at the origin is independent of along which section you take, which is exactly, you know, if you think about it, is exactly what this is saying. It is not the negative piece, which is the one that gives you the singularity, is independent of this mu parameter. And okay, again, you take the corresponding equivalence relation between this, as before, like gauge conjugation by something which is regular. Okay, and then you have the. Now again, we can state a little more precisely what this class of data is like. So these equivalence classes of these flat equisingular connections correspond to elements in the Lie algebra. So in other words, every connection, every flat equisingular connection on this space is always equivalent to something of the form d gamma, where gamma is obtained from an element beta through this iterated integral. I'm simply rephrasing the same thing I said before about the fact that gamma minus was a function of beta through this, but put in this context. Okay. And okay, the fact here to be able to show this, what works is the fact that these flat equisingular connections have trivial monodromies both around the punctured disk and around this other dimension. So it ensures that, in fact, this is a solution. Okay, so, I mean, this says that, well, you can, encode all this data as equivalence classes of flat equisingular connections on this B, on this space B, which is B times G, and this is this vibration with C star delta. Okay. So now, okay, this, so far, again, everything is depends on this group G. But now you want to assemble all this data together so that, you know, for different choices of G in one same category. That's right. Now you're going to start to put everything in a same place where you can compare different theories.
So you were trying to characterize the family of Luke's quorum, but you're translating that family of Luke's to a certain family of Luke's.
Right, so we have translated that family of loop is now a family of connections, of equivalence classes of connections on this space B. That's right, the theorem characterizes them. Yeah. But now, okay, having translated them this way allows you to try to put them together for different theories. And so to do that, instead of working with principal bundles, you work with vector bundles. So now, instead of talking about flat Lie G valued equisingular connections, you talk about flat equisingular vector bundles over the same space B. But basically you're replacing G by its linear representations. And now, okay, you can have linear representations for different Gs in the same category. So we construct a category of flat equisingular vector bundles. So we start from graded vector spaces. I mean, you want to remember everywhere that things are graded, because that's important properties of Hopf algebra. And after all, it is the loop expansion by loop number. So you want to keep that into account everywhere. So you want to have now, so you have a vector bundle with a filtration, which is the one that comes from this grading. And you want connections that are compatible with the filtration. They induce trivial connection on the graded pieces. And you want them to be equivalent by, again, things that intertwine the connection, like one does usually in this category of differential modules and so on. And now, okay, we give the condition that such connection is equisingular, again, by saying that it's invariant with respect to this action of the multiplicative group by this scaling, I mean, the grading of what comes from the grading, and that the restriction to sections are equivalent, as before. I mean, we're just restating these properties of the equisingular connections, but now for a connection on a vector bundle instead of a connection on a principal bundle. That's all. I mean, we're just moving from principal bundles to vector bundles, keeping the same properties of the connections. Okay, so the category has objects, which are pairs of a graded vector space, and an equivalence class of a flat equisingular connection on the bundle, which is now B star, not times G, but times this vector space. So the vector bundle associated to that. And morphisms, okay, morphisms are linear maps. And, okay, they have to be compatible with the grading. And, well, the point is, here one, there's a little technical point, which comes from the fact that if one, here we're working with filter vector spaces, but if one tries to take as morphism linear map that preserves the filtration, this is not an abelian category. That's why, because the filtration on the co-kernel is not the same as the filtration induced from, there is no compatibility of filtration. So one has to pass to this 2x2 matrix trick to define the morphism in a way that you will get something which is an abelian category. So this is a small technical point. Okay, and the result is that the category constructed this way of flat equisingular vector bundles is a neutral Tanakian category. And it is isomorphic to the category of finite dimensional linear representation of a certain affine group scheme. And we can say explicitly which affine group scheme is it? And it is a cross product. Well, this simply means that you're keeping track of the grading, the fact that you have this action of the multiplicative group. And this part is a pro-unipotent affine group scheme, which is dual to a Hopf algebra, which has a rather simple description. It's the dual of the universal enveloping algebra of the free-graded Lie algebra, which has one generator in each degree. It's very explicit. So take the free-graded Lie algebra, one generator in each positive degree. And this is the Lie algebra of the group. Well, it's almost the one that, that Cartier was conjecturing when I mentioned at the beginning, but he was conjecturing something which had only even, not only odd things. But it's almost that. And, okay, so why does this thing show up? I mean, why this group and what has it got to do with? Okay, so maybe I should say that first. Where are the how do you see the different theories? Okay. So this is how you see the different theories. Suppose that now you are given a particular group of diffeographism for a particular theory. Then you can look at the subcategory of that which comes from those flat equisingular vector bundles which carry a representation of this G. Okay. But this means that you have a representation from the affine group scheme of this universal category to this one, I mean, compatible with the grading. Okay. And what is that? I mean, that we can say very explicitly. So this theory will have, when you look at the elements, the beta function, beta is an element in the Lie algebra of G now. And it will have a splitting according to the grading in graded pieces. Well, the representation rho is the one that sends the nth generator of this algebra here to the nth graded piece of the beta function. Well, they encode. I mean, we are looking at the structure of the divergences. So once you have the beta. I don't know how explicit. I mean, you can get the counter terms. You can get all the counter terms. Well, I mean, the thing is that the finite part is not. Yeah. All the counter terms for every graph.
No, but I mean, if I've got a map from the E to the beta, doesn't that mean that I know the group B? If I know the group B, doesn't that mean I know?
Well, no, you don't know necessarily all the group. I mean, you have a representation 2G, but.
Oh.
I mean, you have a representation from this U star 2G, but okay, exactly which part of G it captures. But it's enough to get all the counter terms for that theory. And.
So wouldn't that mean that you can always, by some change of coordinates, take the sum of beta, the sum on n, just have two terms?
I'm not sure what. I'm not sure.
By chance of scheme.
Right.
By redefinition of the coupling concept.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I'm not.
Here we're in a fixed theory with a fixed scheme, so we are not figuring out the.
No, it's not a change of scheme. It's just a redefinition of the coupling concept. But you can always get.
Well, I think that might be a change.
Yeah, I think it does. Because, see, I mean, the conclusion of that is that when you take the right plane, you will no longer have any divergence. So, I mean, it must be a problem.
Right, in fact, let me say this just so. No, that if you take a, if you take this, in particular, you can look at the element. I mean, this is all, I mean, the Lie algebra is pronilpotent, so it makes sense to look at this sum. And that generates a one-parameter subgroup of U, which is the renormalization group, because it maps to the beta function. I mean, this generator maps to the generator of the renormalization group in each of the groups of diffeographisms for each theory. So it's like a universal renormalization group. And this gives rise to, if you use the same formula that you use with a given beta here, this gives rise to a particular frame in this group U, which is the one that produces all the counter terms because it maps to all the gamma minus in the various theories. So it's like the universal, we call it the universal singular frame. It's a universal formula that will map to all the counter terms according to these representations into the various groups of diffeographisms. And this has a nice property that actually one can compute it out explicitly, the coefficients in this basis. And they, there's this remarkable fact that they come out to be exactly the same coefficients that appear in the local index formula. And Alain will say a little more about this in his lecture, but I just mention it briefly. But I mean, this fact that you have this universal singular frame is in fact the key to proving this identification between this category of flat equisingular vector bundles and the representations of this group U. And the way it goes, I mean, the main point, if you want, and proof is a bit longer, but the way it goes is that you show that any flat equisingular connection on a vector bundle is always equivalent to something which is of this form for this universal frame, gamma U, and for some representation of this U star. So you get explicitly from, you know, the connections to the representations. You construct explicitly the functor from the connections to the representations. And okay, actually, no, all this I did over C, but in fact one can do everything over Q also, if we work in the formal setting with formal Lorentz series and so on. And the Hopf algebras are defined over Q. There's, you know, everything works also over Q. And well, I don't know if I can take a little more time, because I wanted to get to the relation to motives, and I have only other two or three slides about that. And I have 2-3 slides. It's maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes at most.
Over Q or over Z?
Over Q. Yes,
there were functions in the universe.
That's right. So, I mean, you cannot improve on that. It's over Q. So what are motives? I mean, just as a general idea. I mentioned it before, but I mean, if you work with algebraic varieties, another way to think about where the idea comes from, I mean, if you work with algebraic varieties, you have a supply of different type of cohomologies that you can use. You have the Ram cohomology, you have Betti cohomology, and you have a Tal cohomology for some, you know, prime different from the characteristic of the field. And these are related by various types of isomorphism, like the period isomorphism between the Ram cohomology and Betti cohomology, or the comparison isomorphism between Betti and et al. Cohomology. So, in general, one asks the question, when you have some kind of operation that you do on one of these cohomologies, when are you allowed to transfer it to another cohomology? And the idea of Grothendieck was that this happens whenever these come from something that lies behind all this cohomology and maps to all of them. And this would be the theory of motives. Like it's like a universal cohomology theory for algebraic varieties that lies between the algebraic varieties themselves and any reasonable cohomology theory.
So it's not itself a cohomology theory?
There is a motivic cohomology, right? So, I mean, there is a first cohomology theory that you can construct using motives and that will map to any other cohomology theory. And in other words, motives are no, it's something like a linearization of the category of algebraic variety. You mean as in the sense of a generalized cohomology theory? Some people have looked at relations. I mean, I think there was some work by Bloch, Peter May, and Igor Krish at some point that looked at certain type of theories of motives from the point of view of this generalized cohomology theory. But I don't know what the outcome is. But I know that some people looked at that under that point of view. Actually, some of the work on the construction of the category of mixed motives that Voevodsky uses a lot of this generalized homotopy theory, this type of category of spectra of. There is an intersection between the theory of motives and that type of homotopy theory, which shows up in different points, including the work of Voevodsky. Basically, the point is that you think of having a way to slice up an algebraic variety in pieces which carry the ith cohomology of the algebraic variety. This also comes up because when one looks at the L function of an algebraic variety, it sort of comes as an alternating product of the L functions of the different cohomologies. And if you look at it all together, you end up with having an infinite number of poles that comes from the zeros of the things that you have in the denominator. But if you can isolate a piece which only carries the ith cohomology, then this is more tractable and has better chance of having a good functional equation and so on than the whole thing together. So you think that the L function is associated not to an algebraic variety, but really to a motive which picks the ith piece of the cohomology. So this is the idea. And yes. So for example, there are different forms of the theory of motives. The simplest one is called the category of pure motives, where you only work with smooth projective varieties, whereas in general, one might want to work with more general varieties, where you are allowed to take complements of divisors and things like that. And that would give mixed motives, which are much more complicated theory. But for pure motives, the point is that you enrich the morphisms of algebraic varieties by not just taking morphism, but taking correspondences, so algebraic cycles in the product of the two variety of the right codimension, modulo a certain equivalence relation. And the choice of the equivalence relation changes a bit the properties of the category. So P is an endomorphism. It's a project, an endomorphism of the algebraic variety. A self map of the algebraic variety, which is idempotent. Okay. So the objects are not just algebraic varieties themselves, but they are enriched by adding, if you want, ranges of projectors. And smooth and project smooth projective algebraic variety, and P is a projector. No. Hom, X, Y are correspondences. They are algebraic cycles in the product of the right codimension. Modulo some equivalence relation. Okay, for example, numerical equivalence relation means that you identify two cycles if their intersection number with any other algebraic cycle in the product is the same. So if they have the same intersection number, that's numerical. Or for instance, another equivalence relation is homological if the difference of the fundamental classes of the two cycles is zero. And there are the properties of the category of motive changes a bit according to which equivalence relation one puts on cycles. So this is a slightly delicate point of the theory. But for instance, for the numerical equivalence relation, it has been proved that the category that one gets that way is a neutral Tanakian category as all the right. You take two cycles, say in the product x times y and y times z. Now you pull them both back on x times y times z. You take the intersection product, and then you map them down to x times z with the push forward. So it's a combination of pullback and push forward and the intersection product. Okay, then you know, there's something else which is called Tate motives, which is the inverse of H2 of P1, and which you also add as objects in the category. And this, I mean, motives have periods like algebraic varieties, and these Tate motives have periods which are multiples of 2 pi I. So whatever you know, you have basically whatever you have a 2 pi I that appears in some, it means that there's some Tate motives involved. But okay, so I mean this category of motives, if you know, for instance, in the case of numerical equivalence and so on, it said they are neutral Telnacian categories. So it's another example where they appear as they can be identified with representations of some affine group scheme. And for example, the category which is generated by just the Tate motives, the subcategory of pure motives which is generated by the Tate motives, has a very simple affine group scheme which is just a multiplicative group. And okay, with this I finish. I want our universal group U to appear finally. So one has to pass to something a bit more complicated, which is mixed motives, which is basically, okay, it is you no longer work with smooth projective varieties, but you allow now things which have complements of divisors and so on, they are no longer compact. But basically, the difference between mixed motives and pure motives, technically the story is much more complicated, but the idea is that mixed motives are things which are not graded but filtered, and they are filtered by the graded pieces are things which are pure motives. So it's something which is built out of if you have a variety which is not a smooth projective variety, you can always, well, at least using resolution of singularity, so put it inside something which is a smooth projective variety as a complement of some, and then you have some kind of stratification, and so you get something which is a filtration, which is a filtration by pieces which are smooth projective. Yeah, it is. I'm just trying to. Well, a pure motive is an object in a category, and a pure motive is just an object which is, if you want, a pair of a.
You made this category out of algebraic varieties.
That's right.
Extended.
Well, that's right. So a pure motive is, if you want, something which is either possibly a sum of things which are an algebraic variety and a projector on it.
Okay.
So a pure motive is something which is
a motive is an object.
Right. A motive is an object, and typically is something which is a sum of pieces which are, well, basically algebraic varieties up to, or possibly, things which come from a projector on an algebraic variety. But, so a pure motive is, you can think of it as something which is a direct sum of pieces which, look like kernels of projectors on algebraic varieties. Whereas a mixed motive is something which has a filtration. Well, whose graded pieces are pure motive. This is a little vague, but it's just to have some kind of mental picture of that. And again, you can take the mixed Tate motives, meaning the subcategory that comes by only looking at the Tate motives of objects. Again, these are things which are have a filtration whose graded pieces are Tate motives, roughly. And okay, one can work over a Bayes field, or one can work over a Bayes scheme. It just makes things a little more complicated. Okay, so there's a result of Delaney and Goncharov that when you do you look at the category of mixed Tate motives over not a Bayes field but a Bayes ring, which is the cyclotomic integers with two inverted. This is a neutral Telnacian category whose group of whose affine group scheme is the same U star that we got from the renormalization. So that U star has a motivic interpretation, has a motivic Galois group. Now, of course, it would be what would be very nice to have is a direct way to go from the Feynman diagrams to the motives in this. So, I mean, here you have you know that both are representations of the same affine group scheme. Both can be identified with the representation of the same affine group scheme. There is a lot of number theoretic evidence in the sense that it's true that a lot of explicit calculations of residues of Feynman graphs give things which are periods of this type of motives, give numbers, transcendental numbers, which are periods of this type of motives. So, I mean, there is a lot of evidence for the fact that there should be a way to go directly from the Feynman graphs or the counter terms of the Feynman graphs to the motives. But, okay, this is not yet clear. Okay, so I'm sorry I took too much time more than what was allowed, but...